To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 508 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week, we're going to be looking at the uncertain financial future ahead of us, and our main talk is by Nicole Foss from Automatic Earth,
speaking at the Transition Network Conference in the UK on the 12th of June this year.
I'm sorry that I don't have the slides which is accompanying this talk, but I hope you'll find it a valuable talk in any case, especially because of the connections it makes between the predictable decline of fossil fuel reserves and the less predictable, the chaotic, response of the financial markets to that state of affairs. It's an hour and 20 minutes, so it's going to continue into the second hour. I'm going to finish the show by reading an article from Michael Hudson called The Language of Looting, that attempts to demystify what's really going on with the banks. Now here's Nicole Foss with her talk on peak oil and peak credit.
People also ask how I came to be doing what I do. People are always asking us what our backgrounds are and things like that. Mine is varied, to say the least. I was a biologist and an environmental consultant. I'm a lawyer. I was a research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, writing books on lack of nuclear safety in Eastern Europe and European electricity policy at the EU level, transmission systems. I moved to Canada 10 years ago, and I've been president of a renewable energy grid connections company. I ran the Agri-Energy Producers Association of Ontario, which is all about farm-based biogas. And I've been studying finance for 15 years. So it is a very varied background. And what that has really produced is a big picture person. That is what I do. And I try and integrate everything that I've done in the past into what I do now and what we have at the Automatic Earth. I was previously editor of the Oil Drum Canada. And they primarily wanted to focus just on energy. So my writing partner and I moved on to found our own site so that we could discuss whatever issues we felt to be relevant, particularly finance, because finance has the shortest timescale, shorter than energy crisis. In other words, it ends up being a defining event for the kind of time frame that you have to play with. So it's something exceptionally important. So we're going to look today at global expansion and contraction, the dynamics thereof, and what are the key drivers over time. We're going to concentrate on energy and finance, and there's water and climate change and pollution and population and any number of other things that we could also discuss. However, we don't have all day. So I'm going to focus on the things that are the shortest time frame and that are extremely significant factors going forward. Some of this particular audience will be more familiar with than other audiences I've spoken to, so I may skim over certain things and expand a little more on others. But in terms of finance, we're looking at deflation and depression. And in energy, as I'm sure you're aware, we're looking at an energy-poor future. It really is going to amount to a century of challenges. And this is the URL for the Automatic Earth, in case anyone may not have seen it before. So energy is the master resource, as again, I'm sure you know, and that we live on an energy inheritance, whereas other societies have lived primarily on energy income. And we're burning about 400 years' worth of the Earth's primary production every single year, which is clearly not something we can continue to do infinitely into the future. Production from our inheritance is peaking. In other words, when you have a large inheritance of something like oil, it's not simply how much there is in the ground that matters. I mean, we still have quite possibly half the oil there ever was in the ground. However, it's how much can you produce from that in, at any one time. And there are limits, especially because we have cherry-picked our energy inheritance and we've produced the easiest, cheapest energy first. What we have left is the much more expensive and difficult energy to produce. And as we move into using much more expensive, difficult-to-produce reserves, the amount that we can produce every year is going to decline. So we are going to have less energy available to society, even although we are not running out of oil in the sense that there not being oil under the ground. So this graph is oil discovery and production. And what you can see is discovery peaked in the 1960s. So when discovery has done this, it's not hard to see that production is going to follow discovery down. There's no way we can continue to increase production when we are not discovering very much at all. When you hear about large fields being discovered these days, off the coast of Brazil or something like that, they mean maybe 3 months' global supply. These are not large fields by the definition of the fields that we were discovering in the 60s, which have been producing now for decades and decades. Now, if all else was going to stay the same, which it won't, but if it was, you would have this red line here is production falling. This is extrapolated forward from where the black line on the previous graph left off. You also have this rising blue line, which is consumption in exporting countries. So at some point going forward, that falling production line would meet the rising consumption in exporting countries line, and you would actually have no oil on the global market, even although there was still oil being produced, because all the oil that was being produced would be being consumed in the countries that produced it. There are various ways to address that have been tried. Walking into someone else's country and removing the competitive domestic demand is definitely one way that has been used. So to give you a sense of just how irreplaceable oil actually is, one cubic mile of oil, which is approximately a year's worth of global consumption, is equivalent to 50 years' worth of production from any one of these things. 50 solid years worth of production. Trying to scale up these alternatives in anything like the time frame that would be required is, well, in some cases difficult, in other cases completely impossible. Essentially, we are not going to be able to replace the energy that oil represents. We will have to make do with less. It's not that the alternatives are not useful, that they can't achieve something. Of course they can. But they are not going to replace oil. We are not going to continue with a business as usual scenario with the same amount of energy going forward that we have come to enjoy. There's a very important concept called energy returned on energy invested. I'm sure some of you are well aware of it. Well, it's a measure of net energy. So it's not just when you have these difficult, expensive to produce oil reserves, it's not just that they're expensive to produce in money terms, they're expensive to produce in energy terms. So you have to reinvest a certain amount of the energy you produce in order to produce more energy. We were once at approximately 100 to 1 for oil fields, say the East Texas field or Saudi Arabia, stick a straw in the ground, out comes the gusher. You get an enormous amount of oil back for very little time and effort. Now we're at maybe 5 to 1, arguably maybe 10 to 1, somewhere in between those two. However, we're at a very, very much lower net energy already than we were not so long ago. And all the alternatives to oil are typically considerably lower in terms of net energy. In other words, you have to put more effort in to get the same amount of energy out, more energy in to get more energy out, which means that you don't have as much net energy available. And there's a minimum energy returned on energy invested to run an industrial society, which is arguably about 3 to 1. So we're already getting into the danger zone. If you look at Hubbert's curve, named after Marion King Hubbert, as I'm sure, again, many of you know, who predicted that oil would in America would peak in the 1970s, which it did, and that oil globally would peak in the early 2000s, which it appears that it has. This is a gross Hubbert curve, the slope with the less steep line. That's not taking account of the energy you have to plow back into the system. So you would have a fall in production, but it's not that steep. The lighter curve has a much steeper decline. That is a net energy curve. That's what happens when you have to take account of the energy you're plowing back into the system to produce more energy. And if you look at the time frame for going from here to here, it's not a lot of time. It's maybe 20 or 30 years, and that's essentially the end of the oil age. Oil ceases to be a useful energy source for anything like what we currently use it for when you have got a tiny fraction of what you once had. So this figure is energy returned on energy invested for a number of different sources. When it says domestic oil, it means American. So this is the early days of the oil industry, 100 to 1 down here at, I believe that was that's of the order of 10 to 1, and then down there is considerably lower. So, and imported oil is really not that much higher these days. Even in Saudi Arabia, it's no longer easy to get oil from under the desert. You have to use tertiary recovery techniques, water flooding. It's exceptionally expensive, and it's difficult. It's technically difficult. So even Saudi Arabia is no panacea anymore, and there's nothing coming up that will in any way replace what the oil in Saudi Arabia represents. Most of the major fields that we've relied on for decades are watering out and are getting, in some cases, extremely close to production collapse. Things like Bergen in Kuwait and Cantarell in Mexico and Ghawar in Saudi Arabia, these major fields that we've relied on for decades are not going to be there going forward, and we're not discovering anything else that will replace them. If you look at some of the other sources, the more renewable sources, things like windmills are not bad, but they're intermittent, and there are obvious issues to do with producing intermittent power. Wonderful as far as it goes, but it doesn't do exactly what the large thermal sources have done. Nuclear power, that some people would say, yes, we need a nuclear future. However, it's not very high above the minimum required for civilization. It's exceptionally complicated. And it also is incompatible with hard times. One of the things I did as an academic was look at nuclear power in the context of the Soviet collapse. And there were some truly frightening things that went on in that era, as I'm sure you can imagine, in terms of how these plants were being run when nobody had any money. You know, it's an activity that requires an absolutely vast amount of coordinated activity by people in a common, reasonable frame of mind. And that was not the circumstance that pertained there. And I would argue that it's not going to pertain here in the future either, so, or at least for a period of time. So I am not a fan of nuclear power for the future. One interesting point to note, if you look down in this far corner of the graph here, the lowest energy returned on energy invested is things like ethanol and biodiesel and tar sands, Syncrude from tar sands. These are so far below the minimum required for civilization, it's just unreal. Things like ethanol actually lose you energy. When you convert fossil fuels to ethanol, you lose energy in the process. The only reason it survives is because of subsidies to the growth of corn in the United States in particular. So in energy terms, ethanol already makes no sense whatsoever. Now, if you're in Brazil and you're making it from sugarcane, that's a different story. You have a much better energy return on energy invested from sugarcane ethanol, but corn ethanol simply makes no sense whatsoever. And tar sands, Syncrude from tar sands, consumes unbelievably large quantities of natural gas. That's why it's so poor in energy returned on energy invested. It's approximately like using $100 bills to light candles. It makes no sense whatsoever. Environmentally, it's an abomination. You know, and you're not even producing energy on any useful scale whatsoever, so it should absolutely not continue. This is another way to look at the energy cliff of energy returned on energy invested. The green underneath the curve is the discretionary energy available to society. The red above the curve is the energy you're putting back in to produce more energy. This is too pessimistic. We're actually more up here somewhere, I would say. However, we are on the edge of sliding off that particular slope in terms of net energy available to society. So net energy falls a lot more quickly than gross energy. The quicker something falls, the harder it is to adapt. So we really don't have a lot of time to be adapting. Throughout this presentation, I will be trying to convey a sense of urgency, both with regard to energy and to finance. I think the quote from Martin Luther in the back of your book about the sense of urgency is absolutely incredibly important and completely true. So essentially, if you look at the spike that represents oil production, the hydrocarbon age is a very fleeting era in human history. There were no hydrocarbons up until recently. We'll have them for a couple of hundred years, and then they will be gone again. Not that there won't be any hydrocarbons, but we won't be able to produce them as an energy source because it will take so much energy to recover them that we would not be gaining any energy for society to use in the process. So this really is a sort of once-in-a-planet's-lifetime bonanza that we have experienced, and we are going to be moving forward into living on an energy income as other societies have done before. So I want you to look at a little more detail for the prospects for renewable energy. Renewable liquid fuels have the lowest energy returned on energy invested, things like ethanol and biodiesel and things like that. That means transport options will be limited because transport is far more dependent on liquid fuels than any other form of energy use. Most renewable energy delivers electricity, some of it intermittently, which is not necessarily a problem provided you build in power storage and things like that. However, that is expensive. That requires a lot of investment. It also depends on the grid. And when we lived here, my husband worked for the National Grid, and so the state of the British grid was dinner table talk for a very long time. Now we work on the grid in Ontario, and there are different problems, but both countries are not in a great state with regard to grid infrastructure, and there's an enormous mismatch of renewable energy resource intensity, demand, and grid capacity. So, for instance, you have an enormous amount of wind potential in the north of Scotland. You do not have the grid capacity to get that power from where it is to where it is needed in places like London or here or anywhere in the south. You would have to build a lot of new transmission capacity down the spine of the country in order to do that because the grid capacity that exists is already very constrained. So there's a limit to what else you can add to that grid infrastructure. Of course, it's better if you can put your renewable energy where you want to consume it. That makes an enormous difference. You don't necessarily have to rely on the grid if you can do that, but your renewable resource intensity is not where your demand is on the whole. Doesn't mean that you can't do anything. You certainly can, but you don't run an industrial society on people having solar panels on their roof. And you're not running industry on that. You're running your own homes, maybe, or at least to some extent. The chance of being able to supply all your own demand is not particularly high, unless one spends a staggeringly large amount of money. However, the real issue is, can you run society, can you run the public sphere with renewable energy on people's roofs? On the whole, not. You would have to rely on larger scale things. And for that, you're almost certainly looking at grid capacity, and that is going to be limited. The investment hasn't really been there. A lot of the infrastructure is at the end of its design life. Continuing to do the same we do now with the grid, either here or where I live, is going to be difficult enough as it is. It's going to require an enormous amount of investment just to continue what we do now. Trying to do other things with it is going to be even more challenging. So we have to be aware that as wonderful as renewable energy is, it does have its limitations. And there are certain things it can do and certain things it can't. It also depends on the time frame. You don't have an enormous amount of time, and doing some of these things takes a lot of time. So I wanted to start to look at the interaction of energy and finance. Energy subsidies drive economic activity because energy is the capacity to do work. That's not particularly surprising. However, when you have very large energy subsidies, you can fuel financial bubbles, which is exactly what we've experienced in recent years. The fossil fuel era has led to the largest bubble in human history by some considerable margin. However, once you have created a bubble, you do not require a trigger for it to burst. Bubbles are inherently self-limiting. You don't have to then run out of energy in order to have a serious problem because a bubble is inherently self-limiting. It will collapse under its own weight all by itself, whether you still have energy around or not. So what we have done is created a structure whereby finance will be the primary driver to the downside in the next few years. Over the short term, finance will be the driver. It's not that we will not have enough energy. In fact, we will appear to have plenty of energy, as we'll see in a little while. For a short period of time, energy will not be a limiting factor, but finance will. The reason for that is that finance is based on pyramid dynamics, along with an enormous number of other things. All bubbles are grounded in pyramid dynamics or Ponzi dynamics. Structures that are Ponzi schemes always depend on the buy-in of new entrants. And there's an enormous range of activities that come within that general category. There are pure pyramid frauds where the founders will set something up. The only money that ever comes into the system is the buy-in of new entrants. It lasts about four iterations, then the entire thing collapses. The founders run off with all the money because it was a pure fraud, and it's over. However, there are a number of Ponzi schemes that have other sources of income besides the buy-in of new entrants. That same fundamental dependency means they will end the same way, but they will last an awful lot longer if there are other sources of income. In some cases, there's no intent to defraud. Any kind of multi-level marketing system where you buy into someone else's team and then you're supposed to attract other people to your team, and whatever they sell, you get a percentage of it, and the more people further down the line, the more the people at the center are bringing in every month. That's absolutely a pyramid scheme, things like Amway, Avon. However, there's no intent to defraud. These are legitimate businesses, and the founders, I think, just did not understand the logic of their own business model taken to its logical conclusion. There are other things where there are other additional sources of income. One of the things I studied as an academic was pyramid schemes in Eastern Europe on the collapse of communism, particularly in Albania. There were some extremely egregious examples of bubbles there. They had much less wholesome additional sources of income. We're not talking legitimate businesses here, at least vanishingly small amount of it was from legitimate business. There was oil sanctions busting and gun running and drug smuggling and human trafficking and car theft from all over Europe. And what these things all did was to bring in a lot of new sources of income. These pyramid schemes ran for years, and running that long, they were able to suck in 80% of the population by the time they burst. And so 80% of the population in Albania lost everything in a very short space of time. Stock market bubbles are pyramid schemes. Housing bubbles are pyramid schemes. There are an enormous number of activities that have that same need to continue to expand or they will collapse. And in every pyramid scheme, only the early entrants really ever make any money. People who come along late are the nominated empty bag holders, the people who will be holding whatever it is at the point where it is no longer worth anything. And unfortunately, the public ends up buying into these things usually very late. What they're basically doing is saying, give me that empty bag. That they don't realize that's what they're doing. But at that point, the insiders are only too happy to say, oh, here you go, by all means, and run off with the money. And the house of cards always comes down in the end when you have something based on pyramid dynamics. So I wanted to look a little bit at how markets really work, because there are some very fundamental misconceptions about how markets work that are very much received wisdom. If you study economics, you will hear about perfect information and perfect competition and rational utility maximization and efficient markets. Not one of those things is true. Markets are not rational, they are not efficient. They're driven by perception, not by reality. It's not what's actually true. The price of oil does not reflect the amount of oil under the ground. It reflects people's perception of whether oil will be scarce or plentiful in the future. And there's a complete disconnect between that and the actual price of oil. Most people have no real information at all. What they're doing is chasing momentum. They're thinking, well, my neighbor just made a lot of money buying that stock, so I'll do that too, because somebody must know what they're doing. And they chase momentum all the way up. More people buy, so the price goes up. So more people buy, and the price goes up even more. And this is, of course, positive feedback. It's positive feedback on the way up, and it's positive feedback on the way down, and it's the way down that we're going to be experiencing for the next few years. People jump on bandwagons, basically. This is a human herding model. Emotions are extremely catching. What people on the way up are acting on hope and greed on the whole and ignoring risk. On the way down, people are collectively acting on fear. They become extremely risk-averse. They act on fear. It's as if someone yelled fire in a theater and everybody tries to run through the door at the same time. Fear is a very sharp emotion. It drives very sharp moves, which is why declines are always considerably steeper than the expansions. And you may have heard a considerable amount about financial contagion in the news with relation to Greece, perhaps. Financial contagion is simply the spread of fear. That's all it is, where one particular asset class becomes a focus of concern, and then people all of a sudden start to wake up to the fact that, well, actually, that over there doesn't look very good, and neither does this over there. And you get this enormous spread of fear. It's completely irrational. The state of affairs in Greece is really not very different than it was a few years ago when people were completely unconcerned. What happens is people suddenly realize that there's something to worry about, and then they all start worrying at the same time, and often they start either collectively selling or causing other kinds of problems, like driving bond rates in Greece up to 18% and things, which is where they were before the bailout, and even now they're 8%. Financial contagion is a very serious problem because you really can end up destroying systems when people are selling through fear alone. And it may have nothing to do with the underlying situation, or at least it may be a complete overreaction to an underlying situation, but people will do it anyway because fear drives them to behave in that way. Positive feedback is the way that financial markets work all the time. It's not simply at times of aberration. This is the fundamental driving mechanism for financial markets all the time. So this is a conceptual rendition of the psychology of valuation. So when you have beginning of an expansion, the smart money gets in, the big players start to pick it up after a while. By the time the public are buying into a trend, it's getting towards its end. It's somewhere between enthusiasm and greed and well on the way to delusion. And if you ever hear the words, it's a new paradigm, sell immediately. The other thing you might hear is, we have reached a new permanently high plateau, which is exactly what they said on the top tick in 1929 before the great crash. Or you very often hear, but it's different this time, but it's never different this time. And excess is excess. Leverage is leverage. All people do is rediscover the magic of leverage every couple of generations or so. When the generation that learned those lessons the hard way are no longer with us, their grandchildren repeat the exact same mistakes again, only in this particular instance on a much larger scale. So you can imagine this as being October 2007. This is March 2009. You are here. We have all this to go. So those green shoots of recovery that you hear about, those would be gangrene. We have a very, very long way to go to the downside, and this is not a long way in the future because we're already beginning that slide. And so the rest of this year, we're going to see this kind of set of emotion building, things moving from fear. We're nowhere near capitulation, but we are going to be moving into fear in the rest of this year. The interesting thing is that where financial markets lead, the real economy will follow. It doesn't take very long to phone your broker and say sell. It takes a lot longer for a real company to go to the wall, start laying people off, go out of business. So if you watch the financial markets, it tells you where the economy is going. This is a leading indicator, finances and credit markets. So you follow those and you watch where the economy is headed down the line. The actual time lag varies. It depends on the circumstances. It can depend enormously on where you are. However, watch what happens to the real economy after finance really turns the corner in earnest. I would argue it has turned the corner now. And so we don't know quite how long the time lag will be, but I am expecting significant effects on the real economy in the not-too-distant future. Here are some famous market manias. We'll just look at the first three. The fourth one is somewhat obscure. This is the tulip mania in Holland in the 1630s. Very rapid collapse. You can see that you don't require fossil fuels for this. This was not a fossil fuel economy in Holland in the 1630s. The reason you don't require energy for bubbles is that bubbles don't create anything real. They create virtual wealth, and it doesn't take much energy to create something imaginary in comparison to creating something real. There's the perception of wealth that's being created, not real wealth. This is the South Sea bubble in Britain in the 1720s. There was a comparable structure in France, the Mississippi bubble, and John Law, and La Banque Nationale. Again, very rapid fall. That's over about 2 years. And bubbles, this was the largest one until the one we're experiencing now. The upheaval that followed that lasted for decades and culminated in a series of revolutions, including the French Revolution and the American Revolution. Which is not to say it was uniformly down for a very long time, but there was a very long period of instability that followed the collapse of this structure. And that's very much what I would expect to see again. This is the Dow Jones Industrial Index, the American stock market in the 20s. It rose substantially in the 20s. It then fell. You are here. That's the top of the great sucker rally of 1930. And there was all this still to come. Thing to notice with all of these is that where you end up is below where you started every single time. So then it becomes important to look at, well, where would you date our current bubble from then, to give you some idea of where we might be headed. Well, you can date it from a number of different places, depending on what degree of expansion you're looking at, because these things are fractal and they're nested, so you can look at it correcting a smaller event or a larger expansion. Essentially, I think the latest date, if you look at stock market charts, the latest date that you could plausibly date the beginning of this expansion to is about 1982, which is when you had the market start to take off after a long consolidation from 1966 to 1982. So if you would say that the bubble began in 1982, then the best case scenario for asset values going forward is the asset values of the 1970s. So you might want to think what your house was worth in the 1970s and then think about how much your mortgage is and whether you still want to continue to own that house. So it's important to look at the nature of credit expansion. It's expanding on the nature of bubbles and why deflation is inevitable. A lot of people understand that inflation, it takes a real wealth pie and cuts it into smaller and smaller pieces. People understand that money ends up being worth less over time. That was what happened in Weimar Germany, what happened in Zimbabwe now. That is not what is happening to us. What we have is a credit expansion. Nobody is printing actual dollars. What we have is credit, an excess of credit, which is exactly what happened in the Roaring Twenties and into the 1930s. That was an credit expansion and a credit collapse. What happens is during a credit expansion, you have your underlying real wealth pie. Instead of cutting it into smaller pieces, the pieces stay the same size, but you create multiple claims to every single one of them. So you have the appearance of wealth. People feel that they own a large slice of pie, but 100 people probably think they own every slice of pie there is. You have excess claims to underlying real wealth. That's what a credit expansion does. That's what leverage does. Rediscovering the magic of leverage takes you an awfully long way up during the expansion. It kills you on the way down, because what happens is those excess claims are extinguished. When you can no longer continue to expand, when the debt that has been created can no longer be serviced, that credit will implode. It will just collapse. Credit is 95% plus of the money supply. When you have a credit collapse, you end up with very, very much less money in the system. This has considerable consequences, as we're going to see in a little while. So to give you a sense of the scale of the credit expansion that we've experienced, this is global GDP at $55 trillion. This is the notional value of the derivatives market at $1,600 trillion. The derivatives market has gone from nothing to $1,600 trillion in 30 years without creating one iota of real wealth. That is the scale of the credit expansion that we've experienced. And that is the size of the structure that's going to implode. So this is value that people rely on. It's not real, but nevertheless, people rely on it. And people will try and enforce the debts that were created in that credit expansion. And the process, as you can imagine, will be extremely messy. People are going to be fighting over who owns every slice of real wealth pie. So another way of looking at the relative scale of different expansions. The first expansion we have here, the smaller one, is the Roaring Twenties, the debt that was built up before the Great Crash, and the deleveraging that proceeded until 1955. The bulk of the deflation and deleveraging was in the early stages of the Depression, up until the mid-1930s, and then there was a slower, shallower fall after that. We have created a very, very much larger debt structure than they had in the 1920s. We're actually more up here now. The way I put this that people can tend to relate to is that the scale of the hangover is proportionate to the scale of the party that preceded it. And we have just had an absolutely enormous party. So the consequences for this will be very significant. We are looking at another depression. And all the circumstances going into it are worse than they were the last time. Expectations are higher, skill base is lower, there are a lot more people, we've built on a lot of the good farmland. There, one could go on. There are an enormous number of factors besides the amount of debt that are going to complicate this depression as compared to the last one. I want to look at what inflation and deflation are in some more detail, because people tend to get extremely confused about this. Inflation and deflation are not measures of rising and falling prices. Prices rise and fall as lagging indicators of changes in the money supply. Inflation is an increase in the supply of money and credit relative to available goods and services, and deflation is the opposite. Rising and falling prices follow from changes in the money supply, complicated by many other factors. If you only look at prices, you take all the explanatory and predictive value out of the concept. Because some prices go up, others go down, and people say, well, maybe you can have inflation and deflation at the same time. Well, you can't. Either the money supply is increasing or it's contracting. It is not going in two directions at once. However, prices are not simply determined by changes in the money supply. For instance, the price of televisions fell over the last decade or so because we offshored the production of them to China, where you could pay people 10 cents a day. So if you do that, even when you have an enormous expansion of the money supply, the price can still fall. So global wage arbitrage is a complicating factor. In a deflationary scenario, you could imagine something that is very scarce and very essential, where even if the money supply is falling, you wouldn't necessarily expect the price to fall because it's scarce and it's essential. So factors like that can keep prices high even when the money supply is contracting. So it's important to look at what's happening with the money supply and understanding that it's a driver and that prices will follow, on the whole, what's happening with money, but that there are other complicating factors that one needs to be aware of. We need to look at prices adjusted for changes in the money supply in order to know what's happening to affordability, because it's affordability that matters. It's not what something costs. It's how much it costs relative to what you've got in your pocket. That's the defining factor that you really need to bear in mind. So we need to look at nominal terms and real terms. If the nominal price and the money supply are falling at about the same rate, nothing has actually happened to the real price. It stayed exactly the same. Affordability is the same. However, that's not what happens in the real world in a deflationary scenario. People tend to think, if I say prices are going to fall, they tend to think that means cheapness. They tend to think this is going to happen, that prices will fall in real terms, that if I say oil would be worth $20 a barrel, they say, oh, you mean oil will be cheap, to which I would say, no, that's not the way it works. It works like this. Prices fall, the money supply falls faster, real prices are going up. People think of inflation as making things less affordable. Deflation will do that far more quickly and far more comprehensively. This is the way it works under the... It can be worse than that, but at the very least, purchasing power falls faster than price in a deflation. So as prices fall, affordability decreases. If your house ends up being worth considerably less, but no one has access to the credit to buy to get a mortgage, only the people who can buy that house in cash are actually buying, and they have to want that particular house from the enormous number that might be on the market. You can see where prices might go from something like that. Access to credit keeps prices up. When you take the credit out of the system, prices absolutely plummet. And I'm thinking oil down the line a number of years. As I was saying, scarce essential things can go up in price even as the money supply is falling, which means the real price is going through the roof. And that is absolutely what's likely to happen with oil down the line. Affordability for essentials could be absolutely dire. Not necessarily permanently, but for a period of time. So what we have in this particular graph, this is a stock market chart, and it's not like one that you would have seen before. This is America, but the same pattern would apply here. If you look at normal stock market charts in terms of dollars, in the case of America, you would see an enormous bump here. In between 2003 and 2007, there would have been an enormous upward move. That was a fall in the dollar, not a rise in stocks. Same for our current rally that's lasted for the last year or so. That's nothing to write home about either. That was basically a fall in the dollar too. What this chart is that makes it different, this is a proxy for real terms. This is the stock market in terms of gold, which is a lot less volatile. You could also do it in terms of oil and various other things. The pattern looks the same if you put it in terms of almost any commodity. Essentially, that shows you when the top really was. It was 1999. We've been in a bear market for 10 years already. In terms of real value, stock markets have fallen 80% in the last 10 years, approximately. And here, as well as in America, you had an enormous doubling of the money supply over that 10 years. So the appearance of rising stocks was actually a fiction. So what are the effects of deflation? credit disappears from the system. It gets harder and harder to get access to any credit at all. We're already seeing, certainly in the States, people's credit limits being unilaterally cut, interest rates going through the roof for credit cards, where the company is trying to dissuade people from taking out credit. Unemployment rises substantially. Aggregate demand falls. And people say, well, people have to eat, and they have to heat their homes. How could demand fall? Demand is not what you want. Demand is what you can pay for. And if you have no money, there is no demand. As demand falls, prices fall, because there is no price support if nobody is buying whatever it might be. Purchasing power, however, is falling faster than price, which means affordability is getting worse, as we said before. So a much larger percentage of a much smaller money supply ends up chasing the essentials. And that means that as everything is becoming less affordable, the essentials are becoming the least affordable of all. This is why you absolutely need to deal with the essentials yourself to the extent that you possibly can. The system that has delivered them here up to now is going to be broken, and so you're going to have to look at providing as much of the essentials as you possibly can for yourself. But then, I mean, you're generally aware of that. That's why you belong to transition. It's important to look at interest rates and the liquidity trap as well. Interest rates need to be looked at in real terms, in the same way that prices are, in order to understand what's actually going on. If you take the nominal interest rate and you subtract the rate of inflation, that will give you the real interest rate. So if I pick two nominal rates out of a hat and a rate of inflation out of a hat as well, you can see that, you know, if you're being paid 5% on your savings or paying 5% on your debt and inflation's 3%, well, the real rate is 2%. If I lower that nominal rate so that the rate of inflation is actually higher, the real rate of interest is negative. That's what happened between 2003 and 2007. Real rates were effectively negative, which meant people were being paid to borrow money. So when Ben Bernanke, head of the Federal Reserve, said he was going to drop free money from helicopters, he dropped free debt. But that is a trap, because when you get into an enormous debt hole, based on extremely cheap credit at the time, it doesn't take much of an interest rate rise before that debt becomes completely unserviceable. So you really end up in an enormous debt trap as a result of periods of negative real interest rates. In a deflation, note the same equation gives you very different results. Now, if inflation is minus 5, in other words, deflation, negative inflation, when you subtract a negative, you add the numbers instead of subtracting them. Real interest rates are always higher than the nominal rate in a deflation. Debt becomes very difficult to service very, very quickly. So if the money supply is contracting, you will have high real interest rates. You won't necessarily see them. It depends. You will be looking at the nominal rate. That's what you actually see, the headline rate. But you have to know roughly what's happening with contraction, with negative inflation, in order to know what sort of rate you're actually paying, and that can be extremely painful. Problem is that even 0% is not low enough. I mean, even if this was 0%, 0 minus minus 5 is still 5%. You know, if you have circumstances where borrowing and lending is not looking attractive, even 0 is not enough if you have a substantial amount of negative inflation. And this needn't be, it's merely 5%. It could be 10%. It could be 15%. Even 0 is not low enough. That's called the liquidity trap. Keynes called it pushing on a piece of string. You can achieve something by pulling on a piece of string, but you can't by pushing on it. So governments simply lose the ability to change the attractiveness of borrowing and lending through the mechanism of interest rate manipulation. So interest rates move in cycles. People were terribly worried about inflation right there, which is just at the beginning of an enormous deflationary depression. This is quite typical, that people worry about inflation as we're moving very close to deflation. Then the exact same thing is happening again. We had an upswing of interest rates and a downswing. We've now gone some way down that red line there. However, we're not that far from the bottom of this interest rate cycle. The next move will be up. And that's up in nominal terms. It will be up more in real terms. The real terms interest rates could be horrendous. You could see real term interest rates of 25% at some point. That is what a credit crunch really is. You know, real difficulty accessing credit and servicing debt. Now, the two ways to look at cash, There's internationally and domestically. So by internationally, I mean what is your pound worth versus euros or dollars or yen. That's actually not the most important thing to worry about. However, I do think the pound and the euro are probably going to come under an awful lot of pressure. And I think what you're going to see is capital flight from Europe, which will actually help the U.S. for a period of time, because there will be a knee-jerk flight to safety into the U.S. As awful as their finances are as well, they will be seen for a period of time as being the lesser risk. You're starting to see an enormous amount of contagion over sovereign debt default risk in Greece and Portugal, and it won't be long before people are starting to think about Ireland and the UK and Netherlands and all of Eastern Europe. All the European periphery is in the same kind of condition with regard to debt. So I think those currencies going forward are likely to fall, and dollars and yen are likely to rise. However, as I said, it's not the international perspective that actually matters the most. From your perspective, what matters is not what your dollars can, what your pounds can buy in dollars or yen, it's what can they buy in milk and bread, petrol. It's the domestic value of cash that matters the most by far. And as asset prices and consumer prices fall, that what that means is the value of cash is rising. So if you still have money, it will be worth more than it was. It will go further. You will be able to buy more things with it than you could before. So if you preserve capital as liquidity, it will actually go a long way. But people will be very reluctant to spend, because if money is hard to come by, if your job is under threat or your benefits might be cut and you're just plain terribly worried that you won't be able to earn money in the future, whatever money you have, you're going to hang on to with both hands. You're not going to go out and blow it on things the way people have been doing on a very large scale for a very long time. So people will hoard cash, they'll hang on to it, not just people, but banks and companies, and anyone who actually has access to cash is likely to be hanging on to it. What that means is a tremendous fall in the velocity of money, the rate at which money spins around in an economy and actually creates an economy. So we're going to look at the effect of the velocity of money, figuratively or graphically. If there's very little money at rest and a lot of money spinning around and around, changing hands in the economy, you actually have a decent economy. However, when an enormous amount of money is at rest, or, well, a very large percentage of the small amount of money that will actually exist at that point, but if most of the money is at rest and very little is actually in motion, you really don't have an economy. The reason for this is think of it as trying to run your car with the oil light on. What will happen is, because there's not enough lubricant in the engine of your engine will seize up. That's exactly what happens to an economy when you try and run an economy without enough liquidity, without enough lubricant. Money is the lubricant in the economy in the way that oil is the lubricant in your car. So you get an economic seizure. You get a period of time where you can't connect buyers and sellers, which is exactly what happened in the Depression. So in the States, you had, say, farmers dumping milk in ditches when down the road people were starving to death. Perverse things happen in depressions when you can't connect buyers and sellers or producers and potential consumers. And in the 1930s, there was plenty of pretty much everything except money. And the U.S. was the global swing producer for oil. There was still a continent's worth of resources. There was cheap labor. The only thing you didn't have was money. When people say, but money is only a fiction anyway, it doesn't really matter, it doesn't have any real-world effect, I would tell them to look at what happened in the Depression. You were at the dawn of the American century. However, there was a significant setback that was the Depression, and these things do happen. Money is not a fiction. Well, in a sense it is, but it has really real-world effects. It's extremely important to look at the effect of taking money out of the system. So this is dollar purchasing power. The graph would look very similar in pounds. This is since the formation of the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank in the U.S. You can see that the central bank did not come into existence to fight inflation. The dollar fell about more than 95% in that period of time. However, the point where the purchasing power of the dollar went up was the Depression, and that's exactly what's going to happen again. So this simply underlines the fact that you need to make sure that you have access to cash if you possibly can, because its purchasing power will go up. If you look at real estate, well, the real estate bubble is global. It's by no means just America or just here. It is in an enormous number of countries. Not every country in the world, but an enormous number of countries have experienced a real estate bubble. because prices were bid up by access to cheap credit. If you give people an enormous amount of monopoly money to play with, then they will go out and have a bidding war with it, and you end up with prices going up significantly, especially prices for property. However, when that cheap credit is taken out of the system, property prices will collapse. And asset bubbles are always followed by an undershoot. So you need to think of what the house price might have been in the 70s, for instance, before you had the enormous expansion. My guess is that on average, real estate is likely to fall by about 90%. And if you think that's inconceivable, well, you could look at what you can buy a house for in Detroit. You can probably do that for $200. Because it's not the sort of place anyone would want to live. There's no work for miles and miles around. Chances are that the house might have a drug dealer on the corner and there might be squatters in the house next door, or the house on the other side has been stripped of copper piping and everything else that was valuable. Nobody would ever get a mortgage on that. So you can see that if the only people who could buy that are the people who could do it in cash and would choose to use scarce cash for that purpose, that's where you get extremely low prices. And I remember when I was living here in the 1990s that they were talking about the council in Gateshead selling four-bedroom council houses for £10 because they couldn't afford to maintain them, and they were just trying to get rid of something that was a liability. So there are enormous moves that can happen, and if there is no potential to earn a living within 100 miles of somewhere, the property price is going to be very, very low. So this is a few housing bubbles in Europe in comparison with the U.S. Germans don't speculate on property on the whole. They don't buy houses assuming that whatever they paid, someone else will pay more later. So Germany doesn't have a housing bubble. That's going to be a wonderful thing for Germany. It means less debt slavery for them. The U.S. is considerably better off than most of Europe. It almost makes the U.S. look like a fine example of fiscal rectitude. If you are Irish, oh dear, essentially. And I have relatives, I have a lot of relatives in Ireland, and I have one particular set of relatives who were able to buy or build a house, a five-bedroom house on an acre of land in the early 1990s for about 30,000 punts. That same house is now worth about the equivalent of 600,000 punts. So property prices went up by a factor of 15 in 15 years. That is absolutely unsustainable. It is insane. And those property prices are going to absolutely plummet. The UK property prices are in a terrible state as well. Most of the European periphery is in the same condition. So this is affordability of property actually in the UK. Just in 8 short years, relative to earnings, this is. Property prices relative to earnings. So you can see how much less affordable the UK got, but then you know that because you live here. So, I mean, this is an absolutely enormous property bubble. It was bad enough when we left. We left in 2000, so not long after this. We left in 2000 because we thought, we don't believe we want to be here when this bubble bursts. And so, actually, you can do a lot if you go somewhere else where property is cheap. We sold a house in Kenilworth and bought a 40-acre farm in Canada for half the money. But it's a one-way trip. You can never go home again. So this is a long time series. This is one reason I like this particular graph. You could do this kind of time series in England because it's you have the data, perhaps, but I don't personally have access to it. This is Holland. So it's interesting if you look at an enormous shoot-up in real prices, prices in real terms, this is, very recently. They just set a new record in real terms. If you look at when the former record was, that's when Holland was a major colonial power, bringing in wealth from Indonesia and places like that, 1736. So for people who say, but if I hang on to this house long enough, it will come back again in value, I would say, well, it might, but it could take 300 years. And in fact, in Rome, it took 1,500 years after the fall of empire. So prices do not necessarily recover anytime soon. I think the odds of them recovering in your lifetime are incredibly low. So once again, think about whether you want to continue to own that particular property. So do you own or do you rent? Well, there's really no safe level of debt. Property taxes are going to get less affordable because what governments do when their tax revenues are falling, they do what a hypothermic body would do, which is to cut off the circulation to the limbs in order to maintain the temperature of the core. Because from their point of view, the core is what matters, and that's what they are, the core. They don't particularly care what happens to the periphery, which is you. So they will try and squeeze more and more money from anyone who appears to have something that's worth something, whether they actually have an income stream to go with it or not. So if you own a large property, you're going to be a bit of a sitting duck for enormous property tax increases. There are also a lot of structural dependencies that go with properties. They're completely specific to the property. So I would suggest definitely looking through what the structural dependencies are in your particular case and seeing whether there's anything you can do about any of them, because you want to minimize them if you possibly can. And you want to be in the right property. If property markets go illiquid, as they do in a depression, property goes illiquid faster than almost anything else. Once property markets go illiquid, you will be stuck. You really won't be able to sell for love nor money. If you're in the right place, that's not a problem. But if you're in the wrong place, it can be an enormous problem. So it would be the right property if, for instance, you don't owe anything on it, you have access to cash, you have family in the area, you can walk to work, especially if work is something that's likely to survive in a depression. You know, there are a number of things that can make somewhere an ideal place to be stuck. However, there are also a lot of other factors that could make somewhere a disastrous place to be stuck. And you can't do what the Americans can do. You can't simply mail the keys back to the bank and say, well, it's your problem now. In America, mortgages are non-recourse loans. If the bank forecloses and sells it for less than you owe, you walk away. It's the bank's problem. In Europe and Canada, that's not the way it works. They will chase you for the difference, pretty much in perpetuity if they possibly can. So being stuck in a negative equity situation is a worse thing in Europe or in Canada than it is in America. So if you owe a lot of money on a property, you're going to end up in negative equity. Maybe you're dependent on a long commute. Maybe your job is going to be vulnerable because it depends on somebody else's discretionary income that they're not going to have down the line. There are a number of circumstances which would say that this is absolutely not the place to be stuck. So you would have to think that through for yourselves, for your own particular situation. And rent is paying someone else a fee to take the property price risk for you. You wouldn't want to do that in a great expansion where someone else will be making the capital gain. But when you're on the verge of an enormous collapse in property prices, it's an extremely good bet, because the person who owns it will be losing more on the value of that property every month than you are paying in rent. So it's not the renting that's throwing money away. It owning throws money away faster during conditions of real estate collapse. It's interesting to look at mobility and social capital. Those are two contrasting factors, both of which can be important. Social capital, you don't have to lose your social capital just because you rent. You can rent where you used to own, for instance. You can have friends and family there. If you own something, you're more stuck, and that's more likely to be choosing the social capital route. Renting gives you mobility. You don't have to lose your social capital, but if you choose to go somewhere else, then you could lose your social capital. But mobility can be very important, because you don't know where the jobs are going to be, you don't know where upheaval might be, or any other number of positive or negative factors that might happen over the years. So mobility can be something that is very beneficial. It can definitely pay to be flexible. What happens to employment? Well, unemployment goes through the roof. And unfortunately, that means that employees will have no bargaining power at all, either collective or otherwise. Because if there are 100 people who would happily take your job for 50% of what you're being paid for it, you're not going to be able to maintain your salary. In fact, your salary would have to fall just to keep your purchasing power the same, because the value of cash rises in a deflation. But employers will not be keeping your purchasing power the same, because they're going to be squeezed as well, which means your wages fall even further. Wages fall substantially and benefits disappear. However, debt servicing either stays the same or it gets worse, because the interest rates could rise. So people can end up in a very difficult situation where the amount that they're bringing in is falling or disappearing entirely, but their debts are still there. This is another reason for not carrying debt if you can possibly avoid it. Taxes rise as well, which adds to the problem of servicing debt. This is a recipe for war in the labor markets. If you remember, say, the winter of discontent, 3-day week and general strikes, that's the sort of thing that tends to happen for a period of time when you move into a depression.